Dallas-Fort Worth Arrival Information Romeo, 2147 Zulu, 6,000 scattered, 12,000 scattered, visibility 10, temperature 101, dew point 67, wind calm, altimeter 2992, runway 18 right, 17 left, visual approaches in progress. Advise approach control that you have information Romeo.
On August 2, 1985, a Lockheed Martin L-1011 airliner crashed into the ground just a bit more than a mile short of the runway on its approach to the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport in Texas. Of the 163 people on board, 128 passengers and 8 crew members were killed. One man was killed on the ground when the plane struck his car. Post-crash investigations found the cause of the crash to lie with the crew, bad decisions, and improper training. But was the weather to blame? Did a thunderstorm pop up so fast that nobody had time to react properly? Were the conditions so bad that no pilot could have saved the plane? Did the crew have the full weather picture as they approached the airport? It was a hot, stormy day in North Texas, and the crew had already been vectored around thunderstorms as they began to turn toward the airport. They had reported seeing lightning as they prepared to land. Air traffic controllers were talking about thunderstorms. One controller reported to the crew a small rain shower near the runway and later described a thunderstorm in the same area. Other crews were landing and taking off normally, but did they have life-saving information that they were not passing on? When the plane first hit the ground, passengers didn't think they were crashing. Some thought they had made it to the runway and had perhaps blown a tire. However, the aircrew in the cockpit was in a fight-to-the-death battle trying to save the large jetliner from a catastrophic ending. After the first contact with the ground, the plane miraculously leveled its wings and lifted back up. But this was only a momentary respite, and the plane slammed down again where it skidded across a busy highway at rush hour. The plane then came to a sudden and tragic stop where it burst into flames just a few feet from its intended runway. This is Radar Contact Lost, the podcast. I'm your host, Dave Gorham. I'm a retired aviation meteorologist with a career in the United States Air Force in commercial and broadcast weather forecasting. I've worked providing weather support to Air Force One and Marine One. I've worked tropical weather in Florida and severe weather in Oklahoma and have briefed flight crews on weather around the world. I've created this podcast series to bring you interesting but tragic stories of airplane crashes that are either caused by the weather or when the weather is a contributing factor to the crash. Today's episode, when Delta Flight 191 crashed a mile short of the runway, is about how a Delta Airlines passenger jet, with 163 people on board, encountered a strong thunderstorm as the plane was on final approach to the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, also known by its ICAO as DFW. The plane encountered what the media termed a mystery killer, but after examining the crash scene and other evidence, it became obvious that a microburst had taken down the plane. What went wrong? Turns out there were some bad decisions made in the cockpit, and the crew got caught in a chaotic and dramatic situation that they could not recover from. But these were not the only errors made this day. Over the course of this podcast, I'll examine the weather and define a microburst. I'll take a look at the role played by the air traffic controllers, the National Weather Service meteorologists, and even other pilots moving through the airspace. I'll take a quick look at the L-1011 too. However, this crash is not just another crash for the history books, if there is such a thing. This crash, what some call one of the most influential aviation plane crashes of all time, became the catalyst for new airline safety procedures that touch almost every commercial airplane, and almost every one of us who flies, even today, more than 35 years later. Toward the middle of July, 1985, I graduated from the United States Air Force Weather Forecaster School. After some vacation time, my wife and I got settled into our new home in southwestern Oklahoma, and I reported for duty at the Altus Air Force Base Weather Station on August 3rd. Having been on vacation, I hadn't heard the news in the past week or two. Walking into the weather station that first day, the conversation was about one thing: the crash of Delta Flight 191 the evening before, and the role a microburst and low-level wind shear played in the crash. The news hadn't reported a cause of the crash yet. It was still focusing on the horrific and tragic nature of the crash itself, yet theories were arising. Perhaps lightning struck the airplane, or perhaps it had encountered a mini-tornado. However, my new colleagues, seasoned severe weather forecasters, and a few even storm chasers, knew the likely cause already. Wind shear from a microburst related to one of the several thunderstorms near the DFW airport. Over the next several days, the public would learn a new term, microburst, because how the crew responded to this microburst is listed as the cause of the crash of Delta Airlines Flight 191. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the airplane, the Lockheed Martin L-1011 TriStar, because its mechanical condition was the first thing investigators examined. This particular plane was purchased new by Delta Airlines in 1979 and had been in continuous service since that time. The L-1011 is a large and heavy plane, but packed with advanced avionics and passenger comfort. Over its career, it has moved a lot of people. If you flew commercially in the 70s, the 80s, or the 90s, there's a good chance you flew on an L-1011. Delta, TWA, Eastern, and British Airways, among many others, all flew the TriStar. Eastern called it the Whisperliner because the cabin was so quiet. TWA proclaimed it as one of the safest airplanes in the world in its 1980s promotional campaigns. The RAF even used the L-1011 as an aerial refueling tanker. Today, all but two TriStars are retired. One of the remaining two is named the Stargazer and is used to launch rockets loaded with satellites that are then launched into orbit. The other remaining airworthy L-1011 has a special connection to me. Well, my wife, actually. And I'll explain why in a moment. Manufactured by Lockheed Martin, the L-1011 was introduced in 1970 toward the end of the golden age of jet travel, right behind the Boeing 747 and the McDonnell Douglas DC-10. These three planes dominated the skies and the airports back in the day. The L-1011 could hold as many as 400 passengers, and its tri-engine configuration, with one engine under each wing and a third mounted high on the fuselage incorporated into the tail section, made it stand out visually. The Boeing 727, the McDonnell Douglas DC-10, and MD-11 are all of the same tri-jet design. In the corporate aviation world, the Falcon 900 is also likewise configured. In its time, the L-1011 was so advanced that its sail was actually banned to potential enemies by a group called the Coordinating Committee, a group of Western Bloc countries that was set up as kind of a Cold War embargo of Eastern Bloc countries after World War II. 250 L-1011s were built between 1968 and 1984. Its automation and autopilot features were so advanced that it was given special clearance by the FAA to land itself in periods of severe weather, while its competitors would have to divert to other airports with better weather conditions. This last feature seems somewhat ironic given the topic of today's podcast. Like many aircraft, the L-1011 served in many roles, from passenger jets and military tankers and even rocket launching platforms. But I think one of the more interesting roles was as the flying hospital. Configured as a hospital and fully equipped to perform nearly any surgery, The Flying Hospital traveled the world performing surgeries in underprivileged countries while providing teaching and lecturing opportunities for the doctors and other medical staffs of the hosting countries. My wife served as the logistical officer on board the Flying Hospital for one of its missions across Asia, from the Philippines to Vietnam and Russia. We have a very nice picture and plaque of the Flying Hospital here in our home. Along with the rocket-launching Stargazer, the Flying Hospital is the only other remaining L-1011 still in airworthy condition. After the accident in Texas, one of the first things investigators checked for was the mechanical condition of the plane. The plane had a clean service record and no mechanical malfunction was discovered. So that brings us to the microburst, the mystery killer, or the invisible killer as the media described it then. What is a microburst? And if it's such a threat to airline safety, how did this Delta jet fall victim to such an event? In order to understand what a microburst is and why it's so dangerous, we're going to have to understand some basic meteorology and thunderstorm development principles. So pull out your pencils and paper because there will be a quiz at the end of this lesson. However, before we begin to learn about the microburst, I think we should be clear about what a thunderstorm is. Here's the definition of a thunderstorm from the Glossary of Meteorology, published in 1959. A thunderstorm is identified as a local storm, invariably produced by a cumulonimbus cloud, and always accompanied by lightning and thunder. That's it. One sentence. Let's look a little deeper. I think we've all heard that hot air rises. Rising hot air cools as it rises, and if the conditions are right, that rising, cooling air will form clouds, water droplets which will become rain, and maybe even thunderstorms. On this particular August day in Texas, with temperatures soaring to more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 38 degrees Celsius, there was a lot of hot, rising air over the state. However, what goes up must come down, and that rising hot air will eventually reduce its upward motion and begin to sink back toward the ground. Inside a thunderstorm, there is a lot of hot air moving up and cool air moving down. These updrafts and downdrafts are literally columns of air that can rise miles above the surface of the Earth, in some cases, well over 10 miles or 16 kilometers high. In a growing thunderstorm, the updrafts are most numerous, but as a thunderstorm starts to weaken, the downdrafts begin to outnumber the updrafts until there are no updrafts remaining and the thunderstorm falls apart. As long as the thunderstorm has a steady supply of hot air, like what a hot afternoon in Texas can provide, it will continue to grow and become more violent. Lightning, intense rainfall, hail, tornadoes, and very strong winds are all possible. Strong updrafts will carry the large droplets high enough to freeze, where they become snow and hail. And with enough strong updrafts, these frozen droplets can rise all the way up to the jet stream. But when the updrafts are no longer strong enough to keep all of this liquid and ice aloft, it all comes crashing back down to Earth. It's literally a downward dump of wind and rain. This is what's called a microburst. Sometimes the downward burst is tempered by the remaining updrafts and only a breeze or some small gusts can be felt, a pleasant, cool breeze on a hot summer evening. But when the whole column of air from a large thunderstorm collapses and rushes downward, watch out. This intense downdraft of wind and rain hits the ground and spreads out in all directions. It could be 70, 80, even 90 miles per hour. That's almost 145 kilometers per hour. These gusty winds spread out for miles and miles in all directions. Some of these outflow winds can trigger additional thunderstorms miles away, as the cool wind undercuts the hot air and sends it upward, where the rising, cooling, condensing process starts all over. The core dump of a microburst is localized. It may be up to 2 or 3 miles across, and it may only last for a matter of minutes. Once it hits the ground, however, the wind will rapidly spread out, 20 miles, 30 miles, even more. One evening, when I was a duty forecaster at my Air Force base in Oklahoma, I let a wind advisory expire as the thunderstorms that had been in the area had moved well away from the base. Shortly after the advisory expired, a gust of wind blew some maintenance scaffolding into the engine of a C-5A Galaxy cargo aircraft, causing minor damage. The closest thunderstorm was 70 miles away. I'll come back to this microburst in a couple of minutes, but I want to set the stage for what the captain and first officer, as well as the rest of the flight crew and the passengers, are about to fly through. The details of some of what I'm about to describe come directly from the cockpit voice recorder transcripts and the investigation report from the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB. But I'll start with an analogy of my own. Imagine a plane traveling through a blast of water from the faucet of your kitchen sink. A small plane, of course, if it's going to fit in your sink, but the mechanics of a microburst are similar to the water blasting downward from the faucet. A moment ago, I described the core dump of wind and rain as a thunderstorm decays and falls apart. This is very much like a faucet blasting water downward in the sink. As the plane approaches the water rushing from the faucet, the plane in your sink will first encounter splashing water on its nose, then the blast of water will hit the plane from above, pushing it downward as it passes through the column of water, and then the water will splash the tail as the plane moves away from the faucet. Consider a large thunderstorm to be the faucet and the blast of water to be the wind. Usually, in order for the plane to be caught in a microburst situation, it's already quite low, typically flying under or through the bottom of a thunderstorm as it approaches or as it's departing an airport. Delta 191 was doing this and experienced the microburst head-on. The plane took the full force of the core dump of wind. But an aircraft can also experience a microburst when the plane is not passing through it, but is adjacent to the microburst. When this happens, the plane will experience a dramatic shove laterally away from the storm. This is dangerous, but it's typically without the significant or severe shear that occurs when the wind impacting the airplane rapidly reverses direction. And because the plane is moving so fast, in this case, more than 200 miles per hour, the microburst event happens very quickly, and the crew has little time to respond, and they have to do it right the first time. There are no second chances. Here is exactly what the Delta crew experienced. Delta's onboard instrumentation first recorded a strong headwind component increase of 2.7 knots per second for 14 seconds. This was a sudden increase in airspeed of about 43 miles per hour, almost 70 kilometers per hour. Immediately after, a 10 feet per second updraft and then a 20 feet per second downdraft was recorded. That's a rapid change of 30 feet per second combined. The initial headwind and updraft caused the plane to gain altitude and airspeed, which then caused the pilot, and it was actually the first officer who was at the controls. So that caused the first officer to decrease the throttles to the three engines. Remember, they're on final approach and trying to land, so maintaining the required speed and descent along the glide slope is critical at this phase of the flight. It should also be noted here that the pilot operating manual for the L-1011 states to not, quote, unspool the engines, unquote. Yet, due to the actions of the first officer, all three engines were very near flight idle and the nose pushed down as they attempted to overcome the strong headwinds and updraft. This all happened in the space of 14 seconds, and as soon as the first officer throttled back, the captain warned him to watch your speed. In the next 10 seconds, the headwind dropped by 25 knots. The headwind in the updraft from a few seconds ago is suddenly gone, but now the downdraft increased to 40 feet per second. The engines are near idle, the nose is pointed down, and suddenly there is less wind flowing over the wings and much less lift. 40 feet per second is about 27 miles per hour, or close to 43 kilometers per hour, that is now pushing the airplane straight down. This is not good, and the plane should be falling, except the plane is not falling, though it is certainly being knocked around quite a bit. Remarkably, thanks to a very skilled pilot dealing with some intensely fluctuating conditions, the plane is maintaining its prescribed descent on the glide slope as it approaches the runway. 20 seconds in, and the first officer begins to realize what he needs to do. With the microburst now pushing the plane down, the first officer slammed the throttles forward to try to gain some speed and altitude. However, the microburst intensifies. The flight data recorder indicated that the plane experienced, well, let me read it right from the NTSB report. Flight 191 encountered an atmospheric disturbance which could best be described as severe and localized. Within 1 second, large variations in wind components along all three axes of the aircraft were noted. Indicated airspeed decreased from 140 to 120 knots. The vertical wind reversed from a 40 feet per second downdraft to a 20 feet per second updraft, and a severe lateral gust struck the plane as well. This gust resulted in a rapid roll to the right, requiring almost full flight control authority to level the wings. This was on page 38 of the 164-page report, which went on to indicate that during the next 3 seconds, the plane's nose-up attitude decreased from 23 degrees to 3.6 degrees, and the vertical wind reversed again from an updraft to a strong downdraft. In 13 seconds, the L-1011 experienced 6 strong reversals in the vertical wind component. It was as all this was happening that the plane was hit by a strong 30-knot tailwind. Despite the full throttle input from the co-pilot and the engine spinning up to full power, the forward airspeed of the plane did not increase. At this point, the plane was less than 500 feet from the ground, and even though the captain attempted to abort the approach and perform a go-around, it was too late. The plane was now experiencing a significant tailwind and loss of lift as it moved past the core of the monstrous downdraft. The plane hit the ground. Its forward momentum, however, was still substantial, almost 220 miles per hour. The pilot was still fighting to save the plane, and the wings briefly leveled out, which actually got the plane back into the air. This was only briefly, however, and the plane slammed back to the ground again. It skidded across Texas Highway 114, where it struck a car being driven by a man named William Mayberry, and then continued onto the airport grounds, very near the airport where it was intending to land. Here, it crashed into 2 large airport water tanks, and this is where the plane's forward momentum stopped. Though the crash into the water tanks separated the tail section from the rest of the fuselage, and it skidded away from the main body of the airplane that was now enveloped in fire. If you've been visualizing this in your mind as we've been going along, you may be out of breath and your heart may be racing. Mine certainly was as I read the NTSB report. But you also might have a few questions. The first being, why didn't they go around the thunderstorm? They could see it on the plane's radar and they saw the lightning from the cockpit. Go around it. The second question would be, how could this happen to such an experienced crew? Some have said that this team may have been the most skilled in all of Delta Airlines. Yet at one point, early in the microburst event, the pilot pulled back on the throttles even when the manual warned specifically against doing this. Going against the manual doesn't sound like something an experienced pilot would do. Not only that, but the captain even expected a possible microburst situation as the scenario began to unfold, but still, they crashed. One thing to add here is that pilot training includes a strict adherence to maintaining the glide slope. Under all conditions, maintain the glide slope. So pilots were predisposed, if you will, to stay on course and maintain the glide slope. There is one exception to that, and I'll mention it later on. Then there's the third question, for me at least, what caused this microburst? I'm thinking specifically of how such a small cell intensified so quickly and to such a level as to take down such a large airplane. Let's address the first question, why didn't they go around the thunderstorm? Several things happened here, and they almost all happened at the same time. Less than 2 minutes before the crash, the first officer called out that there was lightning ahead. At this point, the Delta manual calls to abort the approach and avoid the thunderstorm. Thunderstorm activity, according to the manual, should be avoided by 5 miles. It seems this intensifying cell caught the controllers, the meteorologists, and the pilots by surprise. Even just a couple of minutes before the crash, there was no chatter on any of the radios about this cell. Also, other planes had been landing without issue, and this might have helped the pilots decide to push on. One of the other things that happened involves how air traffic control transmissions reach the cockpit of an airplane. As a plane travels from its departure airport to its destination airport, the crew talks with many air traffic controllers. The broad umbrella of air traffic control consists of many ATC regions, centers, and airports across the country and around the world. As the airplane crosses these regions, the air crew has to change radio frequencies each time to connect with each new controller. Maintaining these communications is critical to the safe operation of aircraft. Modern commercial airliners can have as many as 5 radios on board. 2 or 3 are active, 1 or 2 are spares, but the active ones can be preset for different frequencies, so all the pilot has to do is switch between them. This minimizes selecting the wrong frequency and allows the switch to happen quickly. Setting the proper frequency, which is typically 4 or 5 digits, involves manually cranking a knob on the radio. Hopefully, the pilot doesn't change frequencies when one of the controllers is speaking or following up with additional information, but this appears to have been what happened on the flight deck of 191. 9.5 minutes before the crash, the Delta crew heard the arrival controller report, "There's a little rain shower north of the airport." But shortly after that transmission, the crew switched radio frequencies to pull up a different part of the ATC network, and they did not hear what came next. Quote, "There's a little bitty thunderstorm sitting right on final. It looks like a little rain shower," unquote. Had they heard this, could it have changed the crew's decision about flying through the weather and landing? I'll look more closely at these comments in a moment. What about using the L-1011's onboard weather radar to help avoid, or at least understand, the storm potential and intensification that was right in front of them? This is not a simple question to answer. I'll address the plane's weather radar later in the podcast. The second question, how did this microburst catch out this experienced crew, is also not a simple question to answer. In fact, this is what the entire podcast, the NTSB investigation, and the court trials that would happen later are all about. The trials would take years to answer this question. Let's keep this in mind as we move through the rest of the podcast, because this is where it begins to get complicated. So, what about the third question? Well, the third question is, how did the cell intensify so quickly? If it truly was little bitty, as the controller said, how did it take down the large L-1011? Well, that's a great question, and it seems that things were not quite as they appeared to the naked eye. The cell was growing more rapidly, and it was much stronger than the airport controllers or the pilots knew. The post-crash investigation showed radar images from 2 minutes before the crash, and there wasn't much there. Prior to that, there were some cells farther away, but nothing really of consequence near the airport. The local controllers, both the arrival controllers and tower controllers, are responsible for relaying all significant weather messages to all aircraft around the airport. These messages are relayed to controllers by the meteorologists on duty. At 6 o'clock that evening, almost 6 minutes before the crash, there were no significant weather messages at the tower to relay. The tower controllers are also responsible for relaying weather that he or she observes either visually or on radar, which he did. But the ATC radar is not made for weather. In fact, precipitation will degrade the ATC radar, which is calibrated to detect aircraft, after all. So, ATC radars include circuitry to suppress the intensity and decrease the area of precipitation echoes so that the aircraft are more easily targeted with less interference from the weather. Therefore, a controller might see a weather echo on the radar, and the controller is able to see its size and maybe even detect movement, but controllers are unable to see an echo on the radar scope and call it a thunderstorm. The controller needs more information from the meteorologists in order to do that. As for his choice of words, the controller later testified that because he had not received any reports of thunderstorms, his use of the term little bitty thunderstorm was improper. He said that he normally uses the words light, moderate, or heavy to describe precipitation intensity. The NTSB believes that the controller's choice of words may have been interpreted by the crew as, quote, a description of the severity of the rainfall rather than the size of the precipitation area. The safety board also noted that tower communications to Delta 191 2.5 minutes before the crash described the radar imagery with, quote, reasonable accuracy, unquote. Despite the controller's choice of words, he described the situation accurately, at least as he saw it. Knowing he could not legally declare a cell on his radar a thunderstorm, that's for the meteorologist to do. I think he was coming as close to the legal line as he could, if not actually crossing it, or crossing it but not by very much. He may have felt, well, nobody else is calling this thing a thunderstorm, but I've got to tell them that it's more than a rain shower. Maybe calling it a little bitty thunderstorm was his way of hinting at the potential while waiting to get the official call from the National Weather Service. Either way, it doesn't matter. 191 had switched frequencies and did not hear the last transmission. Other people at the airport saw lightning, but this information was not reported to ATC. In fact, two controllers observed lightning before the accident, and an ATC assistant also observed lightning. Several air carrier pilots at DFW saw lightning north of the airport. One of the air crews reported what they thought was a tornado. Another reported what they thought was a waterspout. A waterspout needs water, of course. Grapevine Lake is 5 miles northwest of the airport, and Louisville Lake is 14 miles north-northeast of the airport. These sightings were all about 2 to 5 minutes before the accident, but none of them were reported to the tower. Had they been, the information would have been relayed to the 191 crew, as well as to all the other aircraft in the vicinity. And that's not just a friendly tip coming from the tower. That information is required by regulation to be relayed by ATC to all aircraft near the airport. The safety board believes that had the crew been aware of these reports, the captain of Delta 191 would have rejected the approach and moved his airplane to avoid the thunderstorms. From the movies, you may know that radar controllers, as opposed to tower controllers, work in rooms with controlled, subdued lighting and no windows. Therefore, they're totally reliant upon weather messages coming from the National Weather Service and the tower. Only 2 minutes before the crash, did the tower relay a report of heavy rain to the radar controllers, but there was no mention of thunder or lightning in this communication. The wind here is a factor as well. The tower supervisor selects the active runway, and when airports are being built, runways are constructed based on prevailing winds for the area. And at this airport, the main runways were set up for landing to the south or to the north, the primary runways being 17 standing for 170 degrees on the compass rose, and at the other end of the same runway, 35 for 350 degrees. This alignment takes advantage of the predominantly south and southeasterly winds across much of Texas most days of the year, as well as the occasional cold front that blows in from the north or northwest. Prior to the crash, the wind had been primarily an easterly wind, which is a crosswind to the main runway. Despite the somewhat varying winds, the tower supervisor selected runway 17 as the primary runway, so airplanes would approach the airport from the north and land toward the south into the wind. At times, the wind swung to a northeasterly direction, but the winds were light, and when investigating this, the NTSB found no fault with the active runway selection. This is worth mentioning. because had the tower supervisor selected the opposite runway, this particular thunderstorm would have been at the departure end of the runway, not the approach end of the runway, and Delta 191 would not have had to contend with it. Of course, this may have created a situation for departing aircraft rather than arriving aircraft, but that's not the subject for today. Also worth mentioning is that if a pilot is uncomfortable with the runway selection based on the prevailing winds, the pilot can inform the controllers of his or her objections, and the runway selection can be changed. Since the controllers are the primary source of weather information for the pilots as they near the airport, perhaps you're wondering about the meteorology training air traffic controllers receive. After all, they're the ones talking to the pilot, they're the ones looking at the radar, and they're the ones vectoring aircraft around thunderstorms. Well, they do have some basic training, but they are not meteorologists. It's not their job to understand the atmosphere, analyze radar returns, take airport weather observations, understand cloud formations, anticipate wind shifts, write forecasts, issue advisories, etc. They kind of have their hands full with their actual job of controlling aircraft. When it comes to the weather, air traffic controllers are relayers of what they see and the information that they are provided by the National Weather Service. I've worked parallel to the National Weather Service for my entire career. It's a big agency, and they have a huge responsibility. The National Weather Service is an agency of the U.S. federal government and falls under NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Per their website, weather.gov, they employ about 4,000 people, which, to me, sounds vastly understaffed given the multitude of varied and far-reaching services they provide. Consider the employees who work at the Climate Prediction Center, the Environmental Modeling Center, the Storm Prediction Center, the Space Weather Prediction Center, the National Hurricane Center, the River Forecast Centers, the Tsunami Warning Center. Well, you get the idea. And then there are more than 122 local weather forecast offices in 6 regions across the country. And let's not forget aviation weather. The National Weather Service aviation forecasters issue specific, coded forecasts for airports that are issued every 6 hours and amended as necessary. There are 21 Center Weather Service units, that's a CWSU, across the country. And these offices are co-located with the FAA's, the Federal Aviation Administration's, Air Route Traffic Control Center, ARTCC. The main responsibility for the CWSU, again, that's the Center Weather Service Unit, their main responsibility is to provide up-to-the-minute weather information to air traffic management and control room supervisors with special consideration to weather that could be hazardous to aviation or the flow of air traffic. They issue advisories and warnings for thunderstorms, icing, turbulence, low clouds, and reduced visibility. They issue AirMets and SIGMETs, which are Airmen's Meteorological Information and Significant Meteorological Information, and MISs, or Meteorological Impact Statements, which is up to a 12-hour forecast for weather that is expected to impact ARTCC operations. I could go on. In fact, what the National Weather Service does could be a podcast or two unto itself. But instead, let's drill down to the late afternoon of August 2nd at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. What was issued, what was relayed, and when? At the time of the accident, the DFW terminal forecast, that's the forecast for the airport, indicated a slight chance of a thunderstorm with a moderate rain shower. The broader forecast was similar. Isolated thunderstorms with moderate rain showers for northern and eastern Texas. There were no SIGMETs, convective SIGMETs, severe weather warnings, local aviation warnings, severe weather watches, or center weather advisories in effect for the area or the time of the accident. Delta Airlines meteorologists prepared a briefing for this crew that included a forecast for widely scattered moderate rain showers and thunderstorms for the area as well as en route. This is not a particularly unusual forecast for August in Texas, and there's nothing in it that stands out as a particular warning for pilots. But now, we have to talk about the radar. This is significant in understanding what was happening to the thunderstorms themselves, but also the kind of information that was being provided to the air crews moving through the DFW control region. How much the cells intensified is just as important as when and where they intensified. We've established a rapidly developing thunderstorm situation at the end of the runway. Now, it would be helpful to know what information the tower had and when this information was disseminated. On the radio, to all aircraft on the frequency, the tower reported, quote, a small rain shower north of the airport. This was just 2 minutes before the crash. Then a larger cell is visible on radar 3 minutes after the crash. That's two radar images spaced 5 minutes apart. And 4 to 5 minutes is about right. That's about how long it takes to complete a 360-degree scan of the atmosphere around the radar antenna, so nothing peculiar here. You may have seen a radar antenna on a ship or in the movies, and they spin pretty quickly, maybe one rotation every couple of seconds or maybe even faster. This is necessary when tracking inbound missiles, but weather radar has to make scans of not only the surface, but up into the air. Getting intensity and range estimates on a cell that is 60,000 feet tall takes much longer than getting a fix on a missile. And so yes, a single scan every 4 or 5 minutes is about right. Now let's consider what the National Weather Service radar operator reported compared to what the tower controller reported, and also what the crew of 191 heard. And let me add here that there are scheduled radar reports taken by the radar operators. But nothing in my research indicated that a scheduled report had been taken, or if or when the Fort Worth office received such a report. The following discussion about radar images is from archival imagery gathered after the crash. The weather radar images were coming from the National Weather Service radar site located in Stephenville, Texas, almost 80 miles to the southwest of DFW. That's well within range of the pre-Doppler radars, which typically have a range of about 140 miles. But the radar has limitations, and the farther away from the actual radar antenna the precipitation is, the more skill it takes to understand what the radar image is indicating. Distant echoes can appear smaller and less intense than echoes closer of the same size and intensity. About 35 minutes before the crash, the National Weather Service radar imagery indicated a VIP-1 cell near the end of the runway, and not much else. VIP is the way the intensity was measured with these radar sets. VIP, VIP, stands for Video Integrator Processor, and it uses a scale of 1 to 6. VIP-1 is weak, VIP-6 is extreme. 17 minutes before the crash, a VIP-2, or a moderate rain shower, developed near the northeast end of the runway, and a second cell had developed even closer to the runway, just 2 miles away. This new cell is the one that will quickly grow into the storm that 191 flies into. But here's what's amazing. 4 minutes after the first cell being detected as a VIP-1, this new cell was now indicated as a VIP-3 strong cell. VIP-3 is the minimum threshold for a thunderstorm. At 6 o'clock, 4 minutes after the previous report, not much had changed, but then 4 minutes after that, the cell had intensified into a VIP-4, a very strong thunderstorm. VIP-4s can include rainfall rates from 2.2 to 4.5 inches of rainfall rate per hour, as well as severe turbulence and lightning. This new VIP-4 report occurred less than 2 minutes before the crash, and the cell was located almost directly in front of 191 as it was preparing to land. So, for 35 minutes before the crash, radar is indicating growing intensity and increasing cell coverage. When the VIP-4 was first identified, the radar specialist called the Fort Worth Forecast Office to report the strong cell. Again, this was just 2 minutes before the crash. After that, he moved on to other radar duties, which included identifying and analyzing other cells. He didn't return his attention back to this particular cell until 21 minutes after the hour, unaware of the plane crash that had, by now, crashed 16 minutes before and almost 80 miles away. The new analysis indicated it had further intensified and was now a VIP-5 intense cell. Reading the NTSB report, I was surprised to learn that the radar specialist was not a meteorologist. He was not qualified to issue forecasts or a prediction as to what might happen to this cell or any other cell. So now the radar information lies with the National Weather Service Fort Worth Forecast Office, and this, to me, is where the system breaks down. Or maybe I should say, this is where the system underperforms. Now, this is 1985, way before cell phones, texting, internet, email, all of the communications that we take for granted today. But once the forecast office has the radar information from the specialist in Stephenville, it then transmits this information to the weather observer at the airport. This is done by computer, and I'm assuming relatively quickly, but this was in the days even before dial-up internet, so the transmission rates were probably okay for basic text, but that's about it. However, once in the hands of the weather observer, it really slows down. The observer has to transmit the information by way of a device called an electrowriter. Have you seen one of these? I'll put a picture of it on my Instagram account. But back when I first entered the field of weather in the Air Force in the late 70s, I thought the electrowriter was the coolest thing ever. But its coolness is embarrassing today. The electrowriter functions basically like a pen on paper. The weather observer handwrites the information with a connected pen on a pressure-sensitive plate covered by scrolling paper. The electrowriter transmits the information to all the agencies at the airport that are on the electrowriter network. This would be the tower, the TRACON, the ground control, operations, maybe even the airport fire department, and others. It's kind of like texting, but it's in the sender's handwriting at the speed of that handwriting. All the users can see the report as it's being written. And it seems, however you write, neat or sloppy, the electrowriter has a way of making the handwriting worse at the other end. Testifying after the crash, the forecaster in charge at the Fort Worth Weather Office estimated that it could take 6 to 10 minutes for a weather warning to be transmitted to all user organizations at the airport. This includes going from the forecast office to the weather observer and then the end users by way of the electrowriter. They had a hotline, though, and they could call the information over to the ARTCC and the CWSU. Again, that's the Center Weather Service Unit. But remarkably, neither the DFW radar or the DFW tower controllers were on that call list. Having received the call from the radar specialist down at Stephenville and having viewed the cell on his monitor, the forecaster in charge at the Fort Worth office testified that he, quote, did not believe it was a storm of sufficient intensity to warrant issuing an aviation weather warning, unquote. But this doesn't really matter. The call from Stephenville was made at 4 minutes after six, less than 2 minutes before the crash. Had the forecaster in charge taken a few seconds to read the radar report, a few more to contemplate the situation, then write up the warning for dissemination, it would have been received well after the crash had occurred. And one last note about the aviation weather warning. In this case, the one that was not issued. This type of warning, surprisingly, is not intended for aircraft in flight, but rather for airport personnel. It's an alert for them to tie down airplanes and equipment in preparation for thunderstorm-related wind gusts. I mentioned the CWSU a moment ago. These are the meteorologists who are responsible for providing meteorological advice and consultation for center operations, FAA air traffic control facilities, and terminal and flight service stations. At the CWSU office, there are also weather coordinators who are FAA employees. These coordinators interface between the National Weather Service meteorologist and the facility air traffic staff. Are you terribly confused yet? I'm pulling all of this detail out of the FAA regulations and orders and from the NTSB investigation report, and I feel it's important because there are so many layers here that it slows the dissemination of critical information. The radar operator in Stephenville takes a radar observation, transmits it to the Fort Worth office, who then transmits it to the weather observer, who then handwrites it on the electrowriter, where it is transmitted at handwriting speed to airport users like the tower, approach control, and fire station and others. Meanwhile, the forecast office then calls over to the CWSU to brief the meteorologist there, who then in turn brief the FAA weather coordinators, who then interface with the air traffic control facilities like the tower and approach controllers, who then talk to the pilots. To me, it's amazing anything gets to the pilots, even on a sunny day. But I wanted to explain that the controller doesn't just look at his radar scope and tell the pilot everything the pilot needs or wants to know. It's about as far from that as it could be. But since we're on the subject of the CWSU, there's one more thing, and this was cited in the report by the NTSB. The meteorologist on duty on the day of the accident took his dinner break at 5:25. Remember, the crash happened at 6 minutes after 6. But I think anybody who works shift work or works a fluid and dynamic schedule knows that you take your meal break, if you're able to take one at all, when the workload allows. At 5:25, weather-wise, things were fairly quiet. I say fairly. There were a few rain showers and there had been a few thunderstorms over the course of the afternoon. They didn't amount to much, and the forecast did not call for anything out of the ordinary. So the CWSU meteorologist took his dinner break, and since regulations state that there can be no food in the radar room, he went to the cafeteria for his meal. He returned to the radar room at 6:10, 4 minutes after the crash. He testified that nobody paged him while he was in the cafeteria. This is the end of part one of when Delta Flight 191 crashed into the ground a mile short of the runway. We've covered a lot in part one, from the definition of a microburst to the complicated way weather information moves from the various weather offices to the air traffic controllers. In part two, we'll take a look at how the weather information moves then from the controllers to the cockpit. We'll look at some common behaviors and some frustration levels with those on the ground and perhaps in the cockpit. The emergence of Doppler radar and the role NASA played in accelerating new technology to prevent a crash like this from ever happening again in the future. We'll also take a look at the NTSB report, their findings and probable cause, as well as where the ensuing trial ultimately laid blame. We'll also take a look at how air safety has improved since 1985. Be on the lookout for part two of this episode of Radar Contact Lost, which should be online in the near future. If you like this episode, give a like, leave a review, and tell your friends. On Instagram, follow at Radar Contact Lost Podcast. We're also on YouTube. If you'd like to reach out, send an email to rclpodcast1@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I'm Dave Gorham.